Dr. Caputo?
Yes.
Mr. Denard?
Present.
Mr. Earle?
He was there a minute ago.
Yes, he was.
There he is. Dr. Harris?
Here.
Dr. Morrow?
Here.
And Mr. Tonner?
Here.
Sorry, I was muted and I didn't realize it. I'm here.
Kevin, I got worried you stayed at the fundraiser last night too long and, you know, you weren't functioning too well this morning.
No, I didn't stay too late. I probably left very soon after you did. So.
All right, agenda item number two. I'll make a motion that we approve the open session meeting minutes from March 20th.
Second.
Any discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
All right. Opposed? Motion carries unopposed. Okay, agenda item three, guidelines and compliance with audit recommendations. Ryan, it's been a little while since we met. You want to just kind of give us a recap of where we left off last meeting and if there's any more points in the audit we need to address?
So, and anybody on the committee, feel free to jump in and correct me, but so what I understand is that the committee's work essentially is complete, that you wanted to look into, and I'm not even sure who made the recommendation regarding South Carolina, but Dr. Caputo, I almost said you, but I was afraid that I might get it wrong, but, and so those are the principles here. I don't know if that's something that you guys want to, I mean, that's up to you, Dr. Hero, and the rest of the committee to entertain those and whether or not we're going to have this stuff. And then because this committee still existed, the board punted its review of the substantial policy statements to this group, basically to either codify them in rule or statute, repeal them all together, or keep the ones you want. And that's, I think, it. I mean, I personally think this will probably be your last meeting, but I'll leave that up to you.
I agree with you, Ryan. Anthony, I guess I'll go to you. Is there anything on the South Carolina you want to talk about?
The only thing to point out per discussion that we were having was that, as you see, I think it starts on 3911, there's a discussion about the principles of ethics and basically how they took each principle of ethics and incorporated into their rules. And so just it was in line. I don't know exactly the topic at the time, but it was in line with the discussion. I know we recently had a board complaint, not that it means anything, but it was interesting that the dentist had responded to an issue that was brought up regarding ethics, saying, well, not being a member of the ADA doesn't, you know, make them make a requirement for them to follow that code of ethics, which we obviously know is not an accurate statement per se, but it was just to show that a state had actually incorporated each of the five principles of ethics into their rules. That's what we decide to do with it. I only can imagine maybe directing the board to think from a future perspective. It has nothing to do with anything that we're doing now, but possibly considering reframing our own rules with respect to that premise or that foundation in the various principles of ethics. That was it.
Thank you. Any discussion on that point?
Hey, Dr. Caputo, do you think it'd be worthwhile to do a substantive policy statement that says that the code of ethics is adopted?
So see how it gets crazy when you go to a different state and it just starts, you know, no, I do not. It really is a reference thing. And it was just, like I said, it was per the discussion we were having. I think you all remember from last meeting or the one before, I'm not a fan of the substantive policy. It doesn't do anything for us. We don't refer to it whenever we're, looking at complaints. So no, I would not want to bog it down in substantive policy.
Okay. Then I'm not sure that it's a good idea to adopt the code of professional. It's actually called the code of professional conduct. the principles of ethics in the Code of Professional Conduct. It's actually an entity or a body of guidelines for a private organization. And I don't think it would be good policy for a state agency to adopt the Code of Professional Conduct for a private entity, because although they would generally govern the conduct of people in evaluating someone's conduct, you could measure it against the Code of Professional Conduct. It could be referred to in a court of law, I guess. But I'm not sure that I think South Carolina is rare, and I'm not sure I would be in favor of it. As big as an organized dentistry person as I am, I wouldn't be in favor of that.
And wouldn't we say that it's very easy for the consultants or the board members to adopt that there was an unethical, unprofessional conduct as part of their review, you know, kind of specifically? It doesn't have to be codified for somebody to say that was unethical and therefore unprofessional conduct.
Mr. Diner.
So I have given this issue some thought since the last time this was mentioned that you're, you know, going to have this meeting to discuss this. And my answer is a little bit complicated, but essentially, you know, I like to complicate things, but essentially I tend to agree with Kevin on this, because there are a few considerations for any state regulatory board to keep in mind when they are adopting ethical principles. So I'll maybe start with the first thing on my mind. It's not necessarily in any particular order, but I think one of the first things to look at is what specific statutory authority the board has to adopt any ethical principles via rules and regulations to begin with. And that is important in Arizona because many licensing boards, all of the, you know, if you go through the Title 32 boards, some boards have been given the express statutory authority to say, okay, you can adopt the ethical, ethical principles for practice of this profession. So for example, with the psychology board, there's a specific statute that says you can adopt specific ethical principles. And then based on that specific rulemaking authority, the board has gone ahead and adopted the ethical principles, as issued by the American Psychological Association, which is the equivalent of American Dental Association for the dental profession. So that's one consideration to keep in mind is, you know, what do our statutes say on this? And in the Dental Practice Act, there is no statute that gives the board the power to adopt ethical principles. It just says, here's a list of all of the unprofessional conduct that is subject to disciplinary action. So that's sort of the first point. The second point is, this takes me back like 15 years when I was clerking on the California Court of Appeal for a judge. So I was basically working for a judge as part of sort of, you know, hands-on training. So there was a case in California about this firearms expert who testified in a firearms-related case. So like a murder case where the firearms expert testified that, okay, the forensics sort of tell us that maybe this person shot the bullet in this direction. And the problem, the murder case was separate, but the problem was the forensics expert there was a question whether that forensics expert had violated any ethical principles of the Forensic Experts Association, which is a private association like the Dental Union, or the, you know, Psychological Association, which is a private association. So the question was, can the court sort of look at the ethical principles that a private organization has adopted and that the private organization can use to discipline its members, and then say as an officer under the control of the judiciary, when someone is testifying, can that person be made to comply with those ethical principles and then disciplined by the court for violating those ethical principles? And the California court's answer was, well, we are sort of venturing into a territory of a private association and freedom of association. So people are free to join or not join any private associations, but people aren't free to not have a dental license and still practice in Arizona. So because of the voluntariness of the relationship between the private association and a member of that association, sure, the private association can use its ethics principles to discipline the private association's member, but we as a governmental institution, the courts in that instance, and the dental board in our example, would not have the authority to take those ethical principles and apply them as if they are rules or statutes that we govern, that regulate the practice of dentistry in Arizona. So those are sort of the two main concerns with adopting or putting any sort of ethical principles via substantive policy statements or through actual rulemaking to keep in mind. And the third consideration is really, I mean, when we start talking of ethics, I think we get into this area where we have to be careful about the list of unprofessional conduct that is already defined by statute. And if, I mean, we are free, I think, as a board to say, you know, whatever the case may be, which could be borderline unethical behavior, which may be actual unethical behavior under the rules, we can just say that's unprofessional conduct. And we don't need to spell out any ethical principles in the rules. We have the flexibility under the unprofessional conduct statutes to say something is or is not unprofessional conduct. In Arizona, there was a case a few years ago, came up from the dental board, actually, maybe like 16, 17 years ago, where the board had decided that something is unprofessional conduct by, and one of the reasons for saying that it was unprofessional was, hey, look, the dental association's ethical principles say this, and you are, you know, sort of way beyond what is ethically allowed under those ethical principles. And the Court of Appeals in Arizona said it is not wrong for the dental board to just say this is unprofessional conduct under the definition of unprofessional conduct. And, you know, an additional reason is, well, it violates ethical principles. But if the board had just said that this violates ethical principles and therefore it violates the unprofessional conduct statute, then that would raise all sorts of questions. So those are really the three main points I wanted to share with the group and see where we go with this. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Banner. Kevin.
Well, and I agree with that analysis, but that's not to say that if we look at the definitions of unprofessional conduct, most all of them have their roots in the code of professional conduct. For example, the payment of kickbacks, for example, is prohibited under the code of professional conduct. Or dental incompetence. You know, fundamentally, a dentist is obligated to maintain their professional skills. When you accuse someone of incompetence, then it essentially presents itself as a violation of the code of professional conduct as well. Advertising rules, false and misleading conduct. A lot of the language that we see in the definitions of unprofessional conduct have its roots in the code of professional conduct, but it's articulated in the statute and, in the statute and in the regs. So, you know, I think given that, I'm not inclined to move toward the adoption of the ADA Code of Professional Conduct in any way, shape, or form, in either statute or regs.
So I guess I would ask if anybody's in favor of it, because if not, I don't know that we need to belabor this anymore. Okay. Then before we move to the substantive policy statements in the next agenda item, I guess just to further clarify, Ryan, this committee's wrapped up its responsibility in reporting back to the board on the AG report. Is that correct?
Yes.
Okay. Then if there's no more discussion on this agenda item, let's get to the substantive policy statements. And I'll just open it up for discussion, or Ryan, if you want to start.
I just give a quick intro. On page 91 of the document is a document that staff went through with Jessica Thomas, who's not in attendance today, but I don't think her attendance is necessary for this committee to meet regarding substantive policy statements. These are our notes collectively. And you probably all read these ahead of time, but I think it's only like two. It's only one total page, and it goes through all 28 substantive policy statements. Oh, and by the way, Rob Holger is on today. He's the board's attorney. I don't know if you want to tell him goodbye. Today is Rob Holger's last meeting for the board. He's not going anywhere with the Attorney General's office, and Seamus Monahan, who was the board's attorney prior to Rob, we'll be joining the board back next week with the Anesthesia and Sedation Committee meeting being its first meeting back.
Great. Well, Rob, thank you so much for your help in this interim.
I've learned a lot, and I appreciate working with the board. It's been very good.
Yeah, I've certainly enjoyed working with you.
Thank you.
Well, that's a good summary document, Ryan. So, you know, I'll just open it up to the committee for discussion on each one of these. It seems like the recommendation on 80% of them is to repeal, a couple of them to kick back to the anesthesia committee, and then one or two that maybe should be added, but let's open it up for discussion.
I say we just focus on the ones that, I mean, I think anything that says repeal kind of answers the question itself. So I would just focus on the ones that maybe indicate maybe some action for further consideration.
Kevin?
I'm not sure that I agree with the conclusions on a lot of these, to be honest with you. For example, substance policy statement number one, infectious disease control in the dental office. I don't know that. When it says it's outside of the board's jurisdiction, no, it's not. Everyone has to operate according to the CDC guidelines for infection control. And if you were going to go and do an inspection and you had a complaint of a dirty office, you would work with the CDC guidelines and say, you're not doing this, you're not doing that, you're not maintaining your sterilization equipment properly. And there's no place in the statute or in regs that makes reference to infectious disease control. How is it outside of the board's jurisdiction? Can someone tell me that?
Because it's federally regulated by OSHA and the CDC. And in fact, the substantive policy statement points directly to OSHA and CDC, and it's dated from 2004.
Wrong. The CDC does not regulate individual dental practices, nor do they regulate hospitals. They establish guidelines, and departments of health and state boards have jurisdiction over the implementation of those guidelines.
That portion is correct, but we can't, and Rob, you can jump in here, but we can't discipline based on a rule that is outside or a statute that has to be tied back to unprofessional conduct within the board's statutes and rules.
Okay, so if you had a dirty office, would you not be doing something that, which is what's your shoehorn definition of something that
unprofessional conduct?
Well, no, I mean the definition of putting the public safety at risk.
3201, just what Dr. Caputo said, 32.01, 101.01, 14.
Yep. Right. So that conduct would be something that would be, that constituted a danger to the health. You'd have to cite the deviation from this, from the standard. It's just like, for example, entities that establish standards for certain procedures, like the American Academy of Periodontology or the anesthesia, or, you know, any of these specialty organizations set up professional standards. And when you state that there's a deviation from a professional standard, the professional standard is not in your statute, but yet the reference to it is within your jurisdiction.
So again, I don't want to split hairs on definitions of substantive policy statements, statutes, and rules that regulate the practice of dentistry. Substantive policy statements are simply a guideline, and there is no standard set in a substantive policy statement, nor can it be upheld in a court of law.
Well, true, but if that's the problem with this one, then it should be in rule.
Okay. Well, and that's what you guys would have to decide on whether this is what was punted to you from the board and whether or not to codify it. As a substantive policy statement, it does not do what it doesn't provide the board the opportunity of what you're stating. And the board can do exactly what you're stating under 3212.01.014. If there's a dirty office, simply because it's an unhealthy office. So they can already cite violations.
Dr. Harris.
A couple of points for this. Isn't the point of a substantive policy statement to not be codified? These are the gray areas and the fine minutiae that maybe don't fit well in specific law and that are deliberately, you know, in those gray areas where we're trying to illuminate those gray areas. But before, I just wanted to comment, I think every one of the substantive policy statements probably could be debated heavily and maybe should be. But I would ask, is possibly part of the problem with these statements that we don't refer to them, that we maybe don't know how to use them, that perhaps what is missing here is not redefining the policy statements, but redefining how we use the policy statements. So, for example, I could get behind there being a substantive policy statement review on an annual basis, where maybe the entire board agrees to reread them and re-vote on them so that they stay pertinent and fresh and viable. Perhaps we need to look at actually reading those substantive policy statements when it comes to the investigative committee. So that we make sure they're being applied. Maybe the issue is not necessarily with the detail of the substantive policy statements, but how they're being used, when they're being used, and how they're maybe not being applied equally or cleverly.
I hate to sound like I'm taking control of this meeting. That's not the intent, Dr. Garrow. So this is my opinion and my opinion only for the moment, but there's several people that agree with me. Substantive policy statements are a lazy way to regulate a profession because you don't want to go through the task of doing a rule or statute. Why do we have 28 substantive policy statements? I've worked with more boards than probably anybody on our staff and probably anybody in our building. And I have never seen this many substantive policy statements, and it's just somebody's way of giving a guideline to the board without actually going through the routine of doing a notice of proposed rulemaking or walking across the street and getting a sponsor for a statutory change. It's completely lazy, it's unjustified, and it's unprofessional. And that's the reason why these need to be looked at. And if you think some should stay, I agree, Dr. Harris, whatever substantive policy statements we have or that the board decides to keep, they probably should be reviewed annually to see, do we need to put this in a rulemaking process or whatnot? I've said enough.
Rob.
Yes, I was going to say I agree with Ryan. One of the issues is you had previously boards that would use a substantive policy statement and use it as a regulation. And one of the things the governor, prior governor, it's been codified is you can't use substantive policy statements as a substitute for regulations. So if it's that really important, then put it in a regulation, and then you can point to it and say, listen, here's the regulation. Now, can you use, hold on a second, let me turn here, to ARS 32.12.01.0115 as a catch-all. Sure, you can use that because you can say the professional standard is you have a clean office. The professional standard is your tools are autoclaved. You do what you need to do to reach a certain level of cleanliness. But if you're going to cite very specifically that this office is filthy, it's beyond, it's just terrible, then you got to go from substantial policy statement to a regulation point. Here's the statute, which would be, you know, 12-01.0115, and then you go to the regulation. The regulation says that you might incorporate, let's say, an OSHA standard and say, as the OSHA standard is amended, we use that as our standard in the regulation. But that was the main purpose, to get away from substantive policy statements. Plus, citizens can go before the governor and say, or file a complaint, I think before, the rulemaking body, and say, listen, this sounds more like a regulation than a substantive policy statement. So just to let you know.
Mr. Diner.
Thank you. Yeah. So I sort of just wanted to go sort of one statement, but you know, look at each statement. So I sort of agree generally with the approach that we should sort of go through each statement and see what we need to do with it. But just on the first one with the CDC, adoption of the CDC office cleanliness guidelines, there are, again, I mean, the answer isn't straightforward. It's a bit complicated. I guess that's going to be my mantra today, but bear with me. I generally agree with Robert and Ryan, you know, we have on, you know, what they said. But in addition to that, when we are incorporating any standards by anybody else in our statutes, or excuse me, in our regulations, there is a specific process that has been laid down by the Secretary of State's office, which came after some of these substantive policy statements were put in place by the dental board. So we have to be, you know, cognizant of that. So for example, in 1994, the legislature passed a statute saying when you're incorporating by reference, so like this, if you look at page 96, it just says guidelines for infection control in dental healthcare settings 2003. That's the guideline from CDC, whoever, OSHA, that we adopted. So it's just incorporated by reference. So when that is happening, we have to comply with ARS 41-1028. It lays out very specific things. It has to be in the rule. It has to have certain information. It can't be a substantive policy statement. And second, the Secretary of State has issued additional regulations to implement Section 1028, which is Administrative Code Section R1-1-414, to say, so basically, I mean, there are four requirements that come from the statutes and seven requirements that come from the Secretary of State's regulations that we have to comply when we are incorporating by reference any standard. I'm not giving an opinion on, you know, whether we should or should not adopt the CDC or OSHA standard. I'm just saying if we think that we should adopt any or incorporate by reference any standard, we should be complying with those statutes, and it can't be a substantive policy statement. And as to the question of whether we should adopt the CDC guidelines or OSHA guidelines, that's a totally separate question, but at least to get the conversation going, at the bare minimum, this should not be a substantive policy statement. We can talk about, you know, going through notes and comment rulemaking to comply with 1028 and 414, but, you know, that should be the starting point.
Dr. Harris.
I guess I look at substantive policy statements a little bit differently. In my experience, they have been used to clarify something that is unclear in a timely manner, which has not been possible, you know, with the moratorium on new rules and with the speed at which the things can get codified, the substantive policy statements were a useful way to clarify for a practitioner. So, for example, for many, many years, there was some disagreement about whether Botox was appropriate in the dental office. many practitioners were, I would argue, operating outside the law. And until it was put into a substantive policy statement, was entirely unclear to the practitioner whether it was allowed or not allowed. And so I do think there's a use for substantive policy statements to be reactionary and make short-term decisions that clarify to the practitioner what's kosher and what's not kosher. So perhaps it's not the substantive policy statement itself that's the problem. Perhaps it's that we don't eventually codify them, that maybe we should recommend that substantive policy statements have a sundowning clause where if they're not codified within 2 years, then they're removed. Perhaps the problem is not the substantive policy statements, which could be a useful tool, but how we use them and how we get rid of them so they don't just become this doorstop that ends up sitting there forever.
So that's exactly, you hit the nail on the head, Dr. Harris. That's exactly what a an SPS is used for. It's a stopgap measure between what is unclear before you get it codified. And the one you brought up is a perfect example, because now it is in statute rule. And I'm not trying to pat myself on the back, but if you look at the last date of the revision of this, it was June 1st of 2012. And there was a ton of professionals that thought Botox should be used for more than a treatment purpose in a dental office, and it should also be cosmetic. So in 2001, this board tried to get, tried to get a bill passed that would have been better than the one that got finally written in 22, but it was trying to get it passed to where dentists, there was no gray area at all. They could do it for either treatment purposes or cosmetic purposes, but it was a stopgap, and it's never meant to be a stopgap for 10 years. It's we're going to do this until we can get this codified, which is exactly the reason why these came before the board, because they came up in the audit also. So we put them before the board to say, you got to look at these and figure out which ones you want to keep, because it's no longer a stopgap when it's 10 years. You have to figure out which one of these you want to live by in statute or law. They punted to you guys, so that's why you're looking at them. I'd get rid of them all, but some of them were created since I've been here.
I was simply trying to point out that we were looking at substantive policy statements as a tool used by the board, and I don't see it as a tool used by the board at all. I see it as a tool used by the practitioner to attempt to clarify something that is grossly unclear, and that's all. So,
Mr. Earl.
Yeah, I agree that the substantive policy statements were really meant to educate people as to what the thinking is behind some aspect of dental practice. Patient abandonment is a good example, and I think we should be proud that we do have something like this, and maybe it needs to be in regulation, but the guidelines are you've got to be at a logical stopping point in treatment. You cannot be in the middle of treatment. You have to follow a format to notify the patient that they're being dismissed from a practice. You can't just abandon them in the middle of treatment. And it sort of shares the thinking. And I use it in my risk management stuff all the time, because, to be honest with you, about a third of the calls that I get from across the country are people that are saying, I want to dismiss this patient. What do I do? And you got to go through an analysis to figure out, how does this get handled? Some states, I know Washington State has a rule on this that might be useful if we want to move it into a rule. But the Botox thing was meant to give people guidance. It's like, hey, what can I do? What are the parameters? How far can I go?
Isn't patient abandonment currently in the rule?
No. Where? Show me.
R411, 501, F, and E.
R411.
And, Kevin, One thing I've been thinking about, which you kind of touched on, you said a third of your calls are related to patient abandonment. Well, so if there's a substantive policy statement right now that there's some frequent use for, even if the board hasn't utilized it, there would be. I think those are the ones to talk about and see about maybe putting in a rule. I can tell you, since I've been on the board, I don't know that we've adjudicated a case about a dirty office. And so, I mean, how necessary is it to put something in rule when we're not really seeing these cases come in front of us anyway, like infection control, particularly if we can turn around and point to standard of care? So, I would back up, I guess, just for the sake of moving things along and say, which of these substantive policy statements do any committee members disagree with the recommendation from Jessica and board staff? Then maybe we pull those out, try to make a decision on the rest of them that we're in agreement with, and move on.
And that's on page, what, 91 or something like that? 90?
That's on page 91.
Well, the only ones that look like it should be pulled are already addressed, Anthony, and I think you would take these to the Anesthesia and Sedation Committee and just verify it by the work that they're currently doing. I'm just looking at the list right now. I've already said I'm in full agreement of what we asked staff to do from our last meeting. So I guess I'm a little, you know, off on the depth of discussion now when the last time we addressed this, we were looking to staff for some direction, and it looks like we got that. I certainly understand that there might not be agreement with it, but it is what we asked to be done, and it looks pretty straightforward to me.
Thank you. And I would tend to agree. So I guess I would ask to hear from the rest of the committee members, you know, if there's any ones that you guys want to pull out for us to talk about. Mr. Diner.
So I think as a starting point, we should pull out the numbers that do not have repeal as a recommendation.
Okay, so for example, there's two that Dr. Caputo mentioned that should be reviewed by the Anesthesia and Sedation Committee, which I think is 17.
28.
And 28. So why don't we, I'll make a motion that we ask the Anesthesia and Sedation Committee to review those two substantive policy statements and provide the board with direction.
Second.
Any discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
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 Opposed? Motion carries.
And then I'm looking at the only remaining one is 22.
Okay.
And I mean, it's subject to discussion because if this committee thinks that that should be in the rules, then we need to talk about how to go about doing that.
I agree that it should be in rules.
Then I'm going to make a motion that we repeal the rest of the substantive policy statements with the exception of 22.
Second.
Discussion.
I don't agree with all of them. I really want to spend some time thinking about it.
Well, we can do it.
It's really hard to get an agenda that's 140 pages long, and this is buried at page 91.
Hey, it's better than 10,000 pages.
Welcome to the dashboard.
Yeah.
Mr. Tonner, go ahead.
Yeah, I think we should also pull out 14 patient abandonment. Cause like Kevin, that's a frequent question that I get from people. And okay. I think the answer, at least the answer that I give my clients is more in depth than what is in the rule.
Okay.
So, for example, what I tell them is there are certain procedures that if they're started, they have to be completed, which would be two-step endo, crown and bridge, and then a gray area is extractions for endo. Because in those cases, you have created a permanent thing that, if not taken care of, can lead to problems. So I think that kind of thing should be incorporated in the patient abandonment.
Well, you know, let me ask it this way. Can we... Is the consensus that we should not, the substantive policy statements that exist that maybe have some value should be incorporated in rule as opposed to an SBS?
Yes.
Okay. Yeah. So yeah. Could we repeal everything and then agendize another meeting to go through what previously existed and make recommendations to the board for rule changes?
Or just work on the, I mean, there's only a couple, it looks like, unless Kevin is, per his comment, really wants to put more time into. Your comment would be accurate if Kevin's position is he needs more time.
Yeah, like, you know, because some of the history, you guys may not be aware of the controversy, Jeff remembers, I'm sure, of the fights that we used to have at the legislature about mercury-free dentistry. And I think there was a statute passed, and we had a wacky senator who would just take this stuff to the end, and it was, there were like bloody fights at the legislature. And that's, I think, what gave rise to those two, these are actually not numbered correctly. Mercury-free dentistry is 10, and then removing serviceable amalgams is 12. But there's some connection to legislative fights about mercury and what you need to disclose to patients and that kind of stuff.
Skip?
The reason for the mismatch in the numbers is
it
hasn't already been reviewed.
Okay.
I was just going to point out that every one of these substantive policy statements is there because there's been some sort of bloody, terrible issue that they felt needed some clarification. Even if we look back on it 20 years later and say, oh, that seems silly, they were all done for a reason. Whether that's still a pertinent reason is a different thing, but we shouldn't forget that they exist because somebody had a real problem in that subject that the law wasn't handling.
Right. But to your earlier point, Skip, if they're there and they've not been codified, then they're just sitting there. That's the lump that we're trying to get around, right?
Couldn't agree more. I just wanted to throw out there, don't forget that they're all there for a good reason. Sure. Even if they don't look like there's a good reason anymore.
Correct.
So we've got 22 and 14. Kevin, anything else you want to pull out?
Well, yeah, 10 and 12 are the one. Because if I go into the statute, I may find what I'm looking for. But and if I talk to John McDonald, John can probably freshen my memory because he was part of those fights. Gene and Dr. Cobb would be familiar with it too. What were the other ones that I was concerned about? And then the sexually 22, where we want to look at some examples. so I know there's some states that have sexual misconduct regulations. We had them in most healthcare boards in New Jersey, but the dental board never wanted to move forward and adopt them because usually they were having an affair with their hygienists. Did I say that? I'm so sorry.
So Kevin, are you saying you do want to visit 10 and 12?
Yeah, I want to just research as to how that happened. I'd have to do a little digging. But, you know, if we can look at it in the future, we can figure out what was the genesis of this.
But what impact does that have with what happened? I mean, I get your desire for a historical perspective, but it doesn't have any relevance now.
Well, it does, because you've got a whole bunch of dentists that are of that holistic philosophy that this drives them a lot, significantly. So you may want to think about it in the context of those cases that you have, and you have had. The diabetes testing, that came out of a ADA, standard on diabetes testing and reporting that came out about 5 years ago. But I don't think in our scope of practice, diabetes testing is not included in it, but it would appear that it would be permissive. And I also think that substantive policy statements are meant to educate your licensees, to share with them how the board thinks about these issues.
Okay. Well, Anthony, again, I think your previous proposal is appropriate, that we should, I guess this needs to be, I didn't appreciate we needed that level of revisitation, but looks like we do.
So, well, I'll rescind my motion, if you want to rescind your second, Anthony.
Okay.
Dr. Harris.
I'm sorry, I was going to go the other direction. I was going to continue to suggest that maybe repealing most, if not all, is the direction to go, because, I mean, as I read them, I don't see the board stopping functioning or any licensee changing their behavior if every single one of these disappeared today.
Correct.
Yeah, and my thought is, you know, and I guess, Ryan, you know, I want to hear from you on this. I just assume let's start with a clean slate. Let's repeal these. And then if there's rule changes that need to occur, you know, let's meet again and use some of the old substantive policies as a launching off point. But as I read through these, I just think they're outdated and not really applicable. And those that are applicable have already been codified. So.
Anthony, I'm gonna add to that, because I was part of a group that put in the dental assistant impression digital thing.
Right.
That was a really big deal at the time. We never had addressed it. We didn't know what we should do, and we needed to come up with a solution in the board, just so that these doctors knew how to, who could take an impression and stuff like that. And I think that was really a great thing in that scenario, because it did give a lot of dentists a lot of resolve to go know that they weren't doing something that was against the law, you know. But at this point,
you have it in your proposed rules now.
Yeah, and that's what I'm saying. And then it went to a rule, but we had to be able to make a decision on what it was first and then put it to rule. And I love the idea of, if we do a substantive policy statement, that we have it addressed before the end of the year or 2 years, because now that policy was made 3 years ago. We already have it in a rule and we're good to go.
So yeah, I thought that was a great suggestion by Skip about putting a sunset on it.
And it puts the pressure on the board to say, all right, just don't let it sit there. Let's actually rule. Yeah.
Right. Mr. Diner.
So I think, I mean, given the discussion, there may be some items that we might need to come back, let's say again, and sort of start afresh with, you know, okay, we need to put something in the rules. But that is only maybe like half of the answer. I mean, me personally, I would say start with a clean slate, repeal all of these. But I think there is value in looking at the subject matter of the things that we are repealing, and then maybe come back to for a second meeting saying, okay, these are the, you know, 3, 4, 5 topics we want to discuss and decide what to recommend to the full board. And the recommendation could either be, well, 3, 4, 5 things need to be in the rules, then, okay, then let's go through the rulemaking process. Or the recommendation is, well, you know, maybe nothing needs to be in the rules because it has already been addressed in, you know, various shapes or forms by the rules or the statutes. And but I guess, I mean, there's value in discussing some of those topics. So that's where I'm my mind space is right now.
Russ. The only thing I worry about is if we repeal them all right now without having the follow-up ready for the rules, there may be some area, and then Rob may be able to figure this out, if there's gray area that we're lacking if we repeal it. You know, so I think we have to do it the other way around, is we have to come up with the solution of the things that need to go in front of the board, put those in front of the board, put them into rule, and then repeal everything else. And again, I don't know. I don't like being the dumbest person on this call.
Addie, do you want to comment on that?
Yeah, so I understand where you're coming from, Dr. Morrow. I mean, I totally get it. So I guess, I mean, the issue is we are viewing the existing substantive policy statements as sort of a stopgap thing that's giving people some guidance for the, you know, months or years that we take to go through the rulemaking process or, you know, get statutory amendments or whatnot. I mean, I completely get like that's coming from a good place. But the problem is under our statutes, substantive policy statements don't carry any force of law. So if ever we come up in a case where we are saying, oh, you violated a substantive policy statement, we just can't use the substantive policy statement as a reason to say, hey, you violated the law. So it's this sort of like weird creature that we can't use right now. I mean, yeah, is it providing some education? Is it providing some guidance? Sure. I mean, but you know, we can never use it. So the point is repealing doesn't cancel all the good work or that we're thinking of doing. It just sort of returns us to a place where let's discuss the issues that these substantive policy statements are tackling, and let's see if we need to go through rulemaking or suggest even statutory changes in some instance. I mean, that's my thinking on it.
And my question then would be, is it easier for board staff to answer the questions of the doctors that call in and say, can I do X, Y, and Z in the meantime without having it in the rules, without having it and so forth? That
goes to Ryan. I don't know. I don't really have an opinion at this point. I mean, I do have a very passionate opinion, but I don't know.
I can't imagine board staff referring to a substantive policy statement. I don't think I've ever heard them do that.
In fact, the exact opposite has happened more than whether it's a board member, the board's attorney, or staff, and it's an attorney, present company excluded, coming before the board, bringing up a substantive policy statement, just, I wouldn't say flippantly, but research, and saying, it's on your own website, and the board looks at me like, this is on our website. And I don't know, you kind of get caught with your pants down when somebody else brings it in front of you and we don't even know it exists. And it's likely dated. I don't know if some of them date back to the 90s, which means they have never been reviewed. Probably, I don't know. Anyway, I've said two cents. There are reasons to have substantive policy statement. And I think Dr. Harris and Dr. Bruno stated it brilliantly why you would have it. But at some point, we have to either repeal or codify. So if it's a stopgap, like Dr. Morrow said on the dental assistant thing, do that. But it's now codified in a rule, and it gives clarity, and you can support it if you have to go back and hear it.
I would submit that waiting until we have a clever way to make each one of these a rule is why they've been there for 30 years and never been touched. We tend to wait and leave it the way it is, and that's how you get these doorstops. So personally, I think some movement on this issue would be useful, and recommending repealing all of them is probably the best way to go, with kind of the understanding that if it goes back to be a continual issue, then a new substantive policy statement could be issued. So perhaps we ought to think about repealing all of them and issuing some sort of recommendation to the board about how substantive policy statements should be made in the future with recommendations.
Yeah, I agree. I'm also, I know we just voted to pass those two to the Anesthesia and Sedation Committee, which they've got a lot on their plate and a timeline to finish. My personal opinion is we should just repeal all this. I mean, I don't think there's, not only we're utilizing it, I think they're old. And, you know, it's just a recommendation to the board. The board can discuss that. And then if at the board meeting we feel as though we should review some of the substance of these statements and pursue rule changes, we can do that. Go ahead, Ross.
And I think that we should then come up with a list to the board of things that are in there that we still think need to be addressed. You know, as a group here, say, all right, we suggest you repeal all the substantive policy statements, and I think we need to make sure we've addressed properly number 2, number 5, number 3, yeah, whatever it is. We go through and then say we need to come up with, make sure we have rules or plan to do so, because like you said, there's reason why all these have been put up there. Some of them may be outdated, but some of them may be pertinent still that we need to make sure that are addressed. Otherwise, they're going to sit there and not be addressed for the next 30 years. So
you think we can hash out that recommendation of the board right now? Which, what material?
I would propose, Anthony, doing just what the recommendations were on the repeal part. But the only reason why I would tell you to hold off on 17 and 28, I believe, was because of the recommendation by staff. But honestly, I mean, that would be something like for myself, I'd be happy to review and just make a comment to you that you could take to the Anesthesia and Sedation Committee. I think it'd be very straightforward.
That'd be great.
That stuff I think is easy. I think it's just the formality of it. But really all the other stuff is repeal. And I think really that's how we should handle it. But if I think there's work to be done, then I would say we would probably postpone and revisit it.
I personally don't think the anesthesia ones are all that big a deal.
Yeah. But worth a review is all I'm saying.
So we want to table this and talk about it at the next meeting?
No, let's vote on it.
Then I'll make a motion we repeal all SBS listed in front of us.
Second.
Discussion.
Now, does that mean it's done, or do we have to put it in front of the board that that's our suggestion?
It has to go in front of the board.
That's just making sure.
Yeah. Do we want, as part of this, to make a recommendation to the board that we may want to look to discuss in rule infectious disease, unprofessional conduct involving sexual boundary violations? And wasn't there one more we were talking about?
Patient abandonment, which I
patient abandonment.
Still don't find what Ryan referred to.
And patient abandonment.
It's fine.
Okay. Let's do a roll call, Sherry.
Dr. Hero?
Yes.
Dr. Caputo?
Yes.
Mr. Dinar?
Yes.
Mr. Earl?
Yes.
Dr. Harris?
Yes.
Dr. Morrow?
Yes.
And Mr. Tonner?
Yes.
Motion passes, none opposed. And Ryan posted the rule associated with patient abandonment.
And did I just hear a gleefully scream by Mr. Ryan that this got done? Yes.
Then, Ryan, are we wrapped up in this committee for now? I mean, I don't know that we should look for another date until the board has a chance to discuss the recommendation and see what action they wish to take.
I think you guys have, give me a second.
While you're looking, the only thing I saw, and I don't know if we discussed it, I just don't remember, there is the issue about fees and having a fee policy. Has that been addressed?
Did you say fees as in?
The report mentioned that there was an issue about how fees were, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah, sorry. So this committee didn't address that. That was a recommendation from the Auditor General's office to staff to work with the AG's office. Rob, in his short time here, got to be a part of that with Mark Harris, and we already have that direction.
Awesome. Thank you.
I think we already wrote a policy. I'm happy to share it with you guys later.
I just wanted to check in. I appreciate it.
Yeah, you guys have another meeting. You guys have a calendar through the end of the year, August 17th, September 21st. I'll just give you those two, and then there's two more. Maybe just keep them on your calendar. That way, if there's a need to come back, we won't have to try to figure out a date. So the next two meetings are August 17th and September 21st.
Cool. Okay. Great. Thank you, everybody.
Hey, thank you.
Ryan, do we have invitations for those two meetings sent out?
Jasmine, will you send those two invitations to this group of people for those two meetings?
Yes.
And then you guys can just hold the slot. September 21st likely won't happen, but maybe August 17th may. Thank you, guys. You guys did great. I totally appreciate this committee and what you've done to help us do this audit. Everybody's been wonderful, and I appreciate the time.
Absolutely. Thanks so
much. Appreciate you all.
You guys take care.
Thanks. Hey, Anthony, do you have a few minutes? I got to ask you a question.